Oh, as I went home on Monday night, as drunk could be, I saw a horse outside the door where my old horse should be. Well, I called me wife and I said to her, will you kindly tell to me who owns that horse outside the door where my old horse should be? Aye, you're drunk, you silly old fool. Still you cannot see, that's a lovely sow that me mother sent to me. Well, it's many a day I've travelled 100 miles or more, but a saddle on a sow sure I never saw before. And as I went home on Tuesday night, as drunk could be, I saw a coat behind the door where my old coat should be. Well, I called me wife and I said to her, will you kindly tell to me who owns that coat behind the door where my old coat should be? Aye, you're drunk, you silly old fool. Still you cannot see, that's a woolen blanket that me mother sent to me. Well, it's many a day I've travelled 100 miles or more, but buttons in a blanket sure I never saw before. And as I went home on Wednesday night, as drunk could be, I saw a pipe upon the chair where my old pipe should be. Well, I called me wife and I said to her, will you kindly tell to me who owns that pipe upon the chair where my old pipe should be? Aye, you're drunk, you silly old fool. Still you cannot see, that's a lovely tin whistle that me mother sent to me. Well, it's many a day I've travelled 100 miles or more, but tobacco in a tin whistle sure I never saw before. And as I went home on Thursday night, as drunk could be, I saw two boots beneath the bed where my old boots should be. Well, I called me wife and I said to her, will you kindly tell to me who owns them boots beneath the bed where my old boots should be? Aye, you're drunk, you silly old fool. Still you cannot see, they're two lovely geranium pots me mother sent to me. Well, it's many a day I've travelled 100 miles or more, but laces in geranium pots I never saw before. And as I went home on Friday night, as drunk could be, I saw a head upon the bed where my old head should be. Well, I called me wife and I said to her, will you kindly tell to me who owns that head upon the bed where my old head should be? Aye, you're drunk, you silly old fool. Still you cannot see, that's a baby boy that me mother sent to me. Well, it's many a day I've travelled 100 miles or more, but a baby boy with his whiskers on sure I never saw before.
You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. Upon my release from the hospital, as a kind of test, I got into a bathing costume and went out to the rocky promontory about 100 yards west of my cabin. I often come here in the evening to stand with a drink of wine or whiskey, to simply view the little lights of the stars above or the little lights of the city below. But it was a craggy escarpment with many small pools of rainwater. To cool down, I often floated in the largest of these pools, a triangular basin about 4 feet at the deepest and maybe 10 feet across. The wind was buffeting hard as I reached the basin near the cliff edge. I swam about for a moment before rolling a nice head-sized rock from the fringe and, placing this boulder over my chest, sank myself to the bottom. A few of the doctors had asked me if I would agree to undergo this old-fashioned sort of test in order to establish that I was, even in some rudimentary way, breathing. Despite my agreement, they later relented, as having found the action too hypothetical, too unclinical, and too antique in its devising. I don't know how long I lay at the craggy basin bottom. Despite my scientific establishments, I had failed to bring a watch, and it may have been only a minute or so when above me a dark shadow loomed at poolside. The wind feathered the surface above me, and I waited for a clean view of my visitor. There was a trail leading up Market Mountain to this point, and it was not unusual for the promontory to be sat with some view-seeker. As I waited for the surface to go to glass, I began to wonder if it were possible that, because of whatever damage my lungs long ago sustained, that some secondary, oxygen-obtaining system had contrapted into being. That some hitherto underutilized organ, perhaps my skin, spleen, tonsils, or appendix, had gone into a Ronin trade and was now servicing me in a way not known to science. Yet before the thought could finish, I found that the pool top had calmed and that I was looking up at a mythical view of a man 20 feet tall standing before a dinosaur. The man had long gray hair darting free from a cloth pile hat and a huge and haggard heapingness of coat. My friend from the hospital and Linny Pond, Winchester. As my experiment was all but cancelled for my forgetting the project's critical tool of proof, I let the rock roll from my chest, and as it struck the bottom below with a toothsome grind, I floated to the surface. I felt a little exposed, not least because I was an old, cold, and underdressed man in a mountain puddle, but also because I felt sure that Winchester must have seen my chested stone and jaw-like drowning. "Anything?" Winchester said, not missing a beat. He was well aware and quite unsurprised, and even, I'd gathered, pleased by my respiratory condition, or lack thereof. I didn't speak as I swam toward him. In the thinning air, the dinosaur had collapsed down in scale, and a black cold steed with a shock of grey mane tugged weeds from the stony surface before me. "I wish I didn't have to breathe," Winchester continued, reaching to help me over the slippery basin's side. "Bloody awful, awkward, everlasting chore." He smiled a little bit and took a dramatic gulp of air and then held it, as though testing whether he might give up the breather's effort. "Don't have a towel. It's a cold day, Sherwin. You're an old fellow. Before you perish, let me introduce Arano," he said, swaying his arm toward the horse. I went dripping to the huge beast and gazed into the chestnut eyes on either side of the spatula face. Her jaws swiveled as she nudged at me, licking at the dripping cold water on my hand. I caressed the flat forehead, a beautiful and exotic animal. We three made our way silently back to the cabin. Arano soon drifted from us to graze in the tall field grass. It had not been my intention to shower, but I needed a fast transfer of heat. I let my hands swivel in the steam water. "I'll have a drink," Winchester announced. I stepped into the warm shower, felt my body temperature glide up, then I cranked the knob to full heat. A few moments later, I had dressed and joined Winchester at the bay window. We could see Arano plodding here and there in the mountain meadow. "Four men after me, Sherwin," Winchester said. "I might have lost them."
"And what are they after?" He took another guzzle.
"I was a water witch, did I say? Used to be, in my day."
"I drank from my own glass," Winchester continued.
"Back through time, the Winchesters have always been dowsers. I must say, finding water with a stick is a quick business that pays well. I can't say that my life was hard."
"So, what are these fellows after?" I said.
"Well, they think I'm a little more than a water witch, that my talents extend to other areas, dark areas." I tasted the scotch, sitting down. Winchester reached into a pocket and fished out a little cloth bag. I took it. It was filled with leaves and sticks. "What is it?" I asked. "Homemade tea, an herbal remedy. 6 parts this, 7 parts that. I'm very poor at math, and sometimes make my tea a little strong. And some find these additions a little repulsive, but my tea can alleviate some conditions. Lumbago, asthma, and it restores pep, vim, and vigor, Sherwin." "I shall never drink any then," I said, as pep and vim were not the pesky energies I wished to manifest. "But a healing tea," I said. Winchester looked a little uncomfortable. He moaned softly, uncertainly. "It can also, under certain conditions, not recommended, never recommended, as any real curing agent will, create those ailments that it treats, which is the nature of, well, nature. And who am I to tell my patients how to use their tea?"
"Do you tell them how to misuse their tea?" I asked.
"I fully inform them of the properties and governing principles at work. Drink it as you normally would tea, without water, I say, but add no addition, and eat nothing for 4 or 5 hours after. But while not telling them strictly how to misuse it, I do provide a full disclosure, only to prevent accidental misuse. Do not use cold water, I say. Do not add honey. Do not, well, I recommend people not drink it at night. They must be informed, Sherwin. I am obligated. They make the tea themselves and in the way they want. But I am held accountable for their misdeeds." I handled the rough little bag. It smelled of mint and manure and bay leaf. "A rumor that the dark man himself has shown up in our little town of Lemon, the so-called Demon of Lemon," Winchester said, a black and knotty gleam in his eye. It could not go without challenge. If he was seeking some assistance from me, I wished to know how far he'd sponsored his own circumstance. "You appear to enjoy this notion," I said.
"Well, it's a fun idea. I can't say I don't mind a little entertainment, a little interesting twist on my reputation. It's gratifying to be thought so potentially venal."
"They can't want to burn you in a pyre for misused tea," I said.
"It's cumulative, Sherwin, the dousing, the misuse of tea, the hovering."
"The hovering," I said.
"A parlor trick, let's call it, nothing more."
He looked out the window as though nothing in the world were transpiring.
"Mr. Winchester," I said, "if you can hover, if you can even jump, I'd be pleased to see it. Then prepare yourself, Sherwin, for an illusion as conjured by the Demon of Lemon. Of repulsive addition.
Get onto the bus that's gonna take you back to Beelzebub. Get onto the bus that's gonna make you stop going rub-a-dub. Get onto the bus that's gonna take you back to Beelzebub. Get onto the bus that's gonna make you stop.
Winchester gazed at the ceiling.
"It's a little high in here," he said, "but I suppose we'll manage. Sometimes I go higher than expected."
He stood, took another drink, then removed his hat. He began to hand it to me, then tugged it quickly back.
"Careful with this, Sherwin," he said. As he put the headdress into my hands, I braced myself for its implied oddity. The idea occurred to me that a mouse, or perhaps even a bird or rabbit, might be living somewhere in the mound. But, greater shock, the hat must have weighed 30 pounds. Winchester loosed the large, heaping jacket from his frame and set it down carefully on the hearthstone. Beneath this body-hiding jacket, he was wearing a sweat-stained linen shirt and some dark, coarse trousers. He bent to the boots, unlaced first one, then the other. "And actually," he said, "it's not a trick. It just happens to be the case." Arnaud whinnied hard and long. Through the window, we glanced a galloping heart for the house. "They're here," Winchester called. He looked excited more than anything else. I kept my eye on the distant plain, and in a moment, following after Arnaud, came a skittering pack of barking hounds. Winchester waved me close. As I approached, he lunged at me. I slapped back at him, but then understood that he was, at the moment, having some trouble moving about. "Take me to the back door, Sherwin," he yelled. He had a vice-like grip on my shoulders, his large hands clamping over each like a child. I stumbled toward the rear door, hauling him after me. "I'll move faster if I leave my hat and coat, but you'll bring them to me, won't you?" "I will," I said, without thinking. Winchester shook me quickly. "Do you understand, Sherwin? You'll bring me the hat and coat." "Yes," I said. I cannot exactly be sure what I saw or what happened next, but as I opened wide the door, my eye fell briefly on Arnaud, who was standing alert at the forest edge, as though waiting for her master's escape. "Come as soon as you can, Sherwin, for they will catch me this time," he said. He rotated in front of me, holding now onto my lapels. He smiled, and I felt myself suddenly blasted back as from a rifle's recoil. I countered forth, rushing back to the door. Arnaud had already exploded into the distance, and Winchester was gone. The dog pack hurtled by the house, and a moment later, four men on horses at full gallop went careening after them into the forest. A moment later, a rifle shot. And then again. I shut the door. Winchester's hat lay on the table, his coat on the hearthstone. Doubtfully, I lifted the hat, sat it experimentally on my head. My spine compressed under the weight. I took a few steps. I tugged upward at the coat. It was as heavy as a wet tarp. As I crossed it on my shoulders and my knees began to give under its weight, I spied the tea bag on the table. A little irritating pep, a little pesky vim might, I thought, given the circumstances, be permitted. I filled the kettle and started up the stove.
10 minutes later, in a weightlifter's sweat, I entered the forest. The skirmish of horse tracks and dogs was not hard to follow, but walking under the 100 or so pounds of Winchester's hat and coat was deeply oppressive. It was not the weight I worried so much about, but how long I might endure it before collapsing like a house of cards. I did not move quickly. I couldn't. It wasn't even a trudge. I took one slow step after another, fighting against the hanging curtains of the jacket every step and trying to keep my head from tipping too strongly to a side. I kept my eye on the trail, as in the escarping distance I heard the occasional rifle round. After an hour or so, I found myself crumbling to the earth. I crawled out from under the hat and jacket. I had heard nothing for quite some time, and the light in the forest was failing. I would not be able to follow their trail in the darkness. I would not be able to follow it anyway. I was exhausted. And, too, I had to admit, I was lost. Seated on the forest floor, leaning against a fallen tree, I hung wearily over my own body, sweat dropping from my brow as from a leaky pipe. I stared, vimless, into the surface of my pant legs, just staring at the tiny stitching. I felt that I might remain locked in this ruined forest-dweller position forever, but also, it was all I needed. To rest was all that I really wanted. And I did. Sleep came, and when I woke, it was to a shiny forest blackness. Between the branches in the canopy above, I saw fierce blue stars. I stood up. The forest ticked with its own stillness. I breathed deeply the air, and at that moment, the deep pleasure and core fact of my returning breath did not register. I only knew that the air tasted sweet and cold. For a long and pleasant time, I simply stood in the forest dark. In some ways, it was hard even to remember how I'd got there. Either my exhaustion had erased my higher functioning, or I'd ceased to have an interest in such causes. I stood, breathing and being. A gunshot. Distant hoofbeats. Barking dogs. I drifted toward the sounds. From nowhere, Winchester and Arano cut across my view, followed hard at heels by the dogs, and almost overtaking them, the four riders. In my reverie, I had somehow managed to get the hat and coat on me. I began my dismal trudging once more, as the sounds of the chase faded into the forest. There are times when one finds oneself less present, or more present, and more or less alive to circumstances. I have been in some difficult positions and found myself engaged in the right action, yet without thought, without my being present in the way that I was used to. To my great surprise, after 5 or more minutes, I found that an odd strength had crept into my body, and that, without too much effort, I was jogging now through the woods. A few moments later, not worried of my footsteps falling through dark shadows, not thinking at all of my old age, or of the heavy clothes encasing me, nor even of the purpose of my movement, I found that I was running as swiftly as ever I had, until, again without much notice, I saw that I had come upon the pack, and, in an adjacent territory, I was shooting over the ground as rapidly as these night horsemen.
Thank you.
I do not know how long we roamed through the wilderness, all of us chasing after Winchester. But the horsemen did finally pull to a haggard halt. The horses stumbled over their stances with shaking legs and great gusting breaths. Not a single dog remained. All had fallen back exhausted. The men dismounted and moved into an open space where the first signs of moonlight began peeking around the crest of the mountain. The four men moved as one. I shifted along behind them, shocked once I got there to see that we had, after all this time, returned to my cabin. On the distant cliff edge, Winchester stood against the velvet sky, standing out on the craggy promontory, facing outward as I often had. His white hair blew in a way that I found arresting. I was surprised the four men had the temerity they did, especially considering their own estimation of the man as something a little more or less than human. As we got closer in the rocky shadows, I heard the snuffling Arano sleeping in the stones near a pool of water. Winchester lifted the whiskey bottle and downed a good portion, still not turning to face his adversaries. It appeared that his plan was that they shoot him in the back, that he might sail forward off the cliff. The men stopped, possibly 20 yards from him, but cutting off all exits. Before I could do anything, the man on the far right raised his rifle and shot. Winchester's body winced slightly before he raised the bottle again to his lips. The man on the far left now raised his rifle. "You will not!" I said, meaning to shout a more traditional stop. But as I was still so largely not under my own control, such specifics could not be guaranteed. The men turned to face me. I saw that my arms were raised in some kind of spell-casting magician's protest. The man who'd raised his weapon was still poised to shoot. "You will not!" I said again. And the man fired, and thankfully missed. In the interval, Winchester had managed to disappear. Whether he'd fallen, I could not tell, but they had approached him in such a way that his only way to freedom would have been through their ranks. While two of them kept their rifles on me at the distance, the other two scrambled over the promontory until they were satisfied, apparently, that Winchester was gone. As I was wearing Winchester's coat and hat, there must be some seeming magicality to the entire circumstance, at least for them. The four men gathered again and, guns raised, came stalking toward me. I lowered my arms. Whatever was guiding me along had no next move, except I would allow them to come. I would allow whatever followed. The men stopped 10 feet from me. One of the men withdrew a flashlight and shone it on my face, and then, in whispers, they conferred. "Who are you?" one of them finally said. I told them my name and that I lived here. They asked me about the hat and the coat. I had no response, and so stayed silent. The men came closer, peered into my face. One of them pushed at me, gently, more to make sure I was real, and then, without another word between us, the four men walked back to their horses, mounted up, and trotted off down Market Mountain. Arano rose and came to join me, and together we walked out over the promontory. The moon reflected down onto the clear water, filling the triangular basin where I had, just that morning, tested my breath. But it was enough to see the figure laying beneath, enough to see Winchester holding my rock over his chest, and, too, with the addition of the whiskey bottle, which he waved at me slowly under the water. He surfaced. "Anything?" I asked. He rose into standing, took yet another sip from my whiskey bottle. I reached forward to help him up the slippery basin's side. "I wish I didn't have to breathe," I said. "Bloody, awful, awkward, everlasting jaw." You've been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.